Boom! Hello, 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 hello to the listeners, and hello to the Patreon subscribers who can actually see my beautiful, beautiful visage. Does that mean face? Visage. I mean face. Face. Yes. So yeah, I have to apologize about the lateness of this episode. I've been a bit up and down mental health wise. I relapsed. Get that out there. I fucking relapsed. I think I had a minor breakdown as well. I mean, it was a bit. Problem is, right, I was wearing, I'd run out of clean shorts to wear to bed. I usually wear basketball shorts to bed and a vest. I didn't have any basketball shorts. I only had swimming trunks. So I wore swimming trunks and had a vest. And there was a point where I got overwhelmed and I decided to go jogging in the snow in my swimming trunks and my vest. Once the adrenaline had dissipated, I was very, very conscious of my fat tits and belly. And the fact I was wearing swimming trunks and a vest, and a lot of concern emanating from my neighbours and just the people downtown, just the people in the town. I was really frantic and manic. But what started as a run soon became a jog. A kind of casual jiggly jog because I am fat now. And then at that point, I'd come to my senses and my sense of reality had reasserted itself. And I was very aware of like, yeah, I'm a mad cunt. This is mad. You're looking mad. And I had a fat off bolognese stain down my vest. It wasn't actually bolognese. I think it was just a bit of tomato paste, which is in bolognese. Yeah, anyway. So, yeah. But good. Feeling good now. Went through withdrawal. Quite brutal, but not as... I mean, God, nothing like the withdrawal I went through years ago before I went to rehab. Oh, mama. Oh, that boy stung. It didn't just sting. It was so spirit emptying. everything, every life enhancing quality, everything leaves you. Everything leaves you. You are truly, well and truly a husk. It's a strange experience. I'll read it out a bit. So when I first went to a TV, a desk, a bath, and a serviceable bed, like a budget hotel just off the city centre, the kind of room I'd slink back to after a gig and a midnight writing session in Wetherspoons, right? So like, explain the logistics of a demented man fucking a keyboard. Sunil Patel, in the last gig we did, he brought that to my attention. I did a bit about a man fucking a keyboard, and he wanted to know the logistics of it. I said, you fuck the port. Obviously, you need an incredibly thin, tiny, tiny penis. So abnormally small penis that doesn't exist in reality, which adds a whole nother dimension. It becomes too, you're focusing on too many different things at that point. You're like, okay, so he's got like a dick vine. He's got like a little dick cable. But why is, that's weird. Do you know what I mean? It's not anchored in reality at any point then. I mean, it's already absurd, but like a man fucking a cable, but yeah, anyway, still got to work through that. Got to work out how to get away with that premise. Got to make sure there's not there's not too much maths in it, which is what Key and Peele say when they were writing about a sketch. They say it's got too much maths. It's got to take too many mental leaps, too many logical leaps, which become a distraction. So you've got to strip away some of the stuff to get to the funny. So yeah, I'd be after gigs, midnight writing session in Wetherspoons while nursing a Diet Coke, utterly alone. On one occasion, gigging in Birmingham, I actually met up with Mark Silcox, who, you know, his uncle Shady in Man Like Mo Bean. I love Mark to bits. He's just a fascinating figure. We kind of go for a little walk and chit chat and stuff. And he's just had quite an interesting life. Can't quite get a handle on his background and his autobiography. There's a lot to unpack there, which is, you know, makes for a fascinating company. I just really like Mark. He's a really funny, brilliant guy. He bought me a big bar of chocolate and a pint of milk, completely unprompted. He was actually filming the third series of Man Like Mo Bean in Birmingham, came to watch me perform. He invited me back to his hotel room, and then we napped for 2 hours in his hotel room, both of us on his double bed, as if we're Morecambe and Wise, before I caught the overnight coach back to London. Nice memory. I really wish I'd got a picture of us two. It just felt very comfortable. It didn't feel strange. It felt like this is where we both need to be. We both need to be just lying on top of the covers, side by side, having a little nap like Morecambe and Wise. Just buddies. So yeah, despite the neutral surroundings in rehab and in this bedroom that I was in rehab, everything felt loaded and vaguely punitive. Mum sat with her bag on her knees. Dad stood the way my brother and I always stand, which is, the people who are listening won't be able to see this, sort of upright, chest out, the back of our wrists pressing into our hips with our hands pointing outwards like that. Sort of a slightly au fait Superman, slightly camp Superman. And this feeling, which was of personal shame and circumspection on behalf of the care assistants, was only enhanced by placid introductions and a housekeeping speech delivered by Adolf, a man with albinism, if I'm pronouncing that right. Adolf the albino, he was an albino man called Adolf. Not quite sure where he came from. I think he might have been South African. He had a South African accent, if I remember correctly. I was a bit sponged out at that point, so I'm not 100% sure, so don't quote me on that. But yeah, swear to God, Adolf the albino. And I respect the fact that he didn't actually draw attention to it, but I was unnerved by this unspoken detail. Not the name or the albinism, just the combination of the two and his refusal to remark on it. You'd think he'd at least mention it, wouldn't you? But then maybe there's so much of his life is mentioning that. They just thought, I can't be fucking bothered. Accept me as I am. Accept me on my own terms. Sorry. Are you fucking bothered? It's all part of it. Accept me as the offcuts of life. Strenuous part of life. Accept me on my own terms. I wanted to just add a bit that made it seem like I wasn't being horrible to Adolf, in case he read it. And there was also the juxtaposition of Adolf giving a speech about sanctuary and restoration while my toiletries were searched for razor blades and my belt and shoelaces were put into Ziploc bags. Dad, who is both tactless and desensitized to stories about cell block hangings, joked that I could easily use a strip of the bedsheet there, in case you wanted any tips. Don't know what the first night's like. Depends what's on the telly. That's what my dad said. And Mum pulled a face, pinching, twizzling, and breaking off the end of Dad's words with only a glare. The silent transmission between two people who've been together for a lifetime. That level of intimacy where you can give your husband a bollocking without saying anything. Bollocking. Single word passing your lips. I knew I was a drug addict. I never deluded. By the way, in case you haven't realised already, tip tap tappy tip tap is because this is probably going to be in the book. It's actually the rehab diary. I'm actually revisiting the daily diaries that we would write in rehab. Weird kind of experience for me to go down memory lane there, especially as I'm newly clean again, having relapsed for longer than I'm telling people, but that's between us. So I always knew I was a drug addict. I never deluded myself into thinking otherwise. And right from the beginning, I didn't buy into the literary romanticized notion of drug abuse, even like the Artful Desolation of Trainspotting, which there is a certain amount of verisimilitude to Trainspotting, and the desolation isn't aspirational, is it? You don't read Trainspotting and think, yes, I want to be in that. I want to have fucking verrucas on my lips. I want to be one of those guys. But there's still, there can be something enticing about a life falling to pieces, and about those that kind of desolate lifestyle. Portent, that was the word I was looking for earlier. Sorry, I'll stay in a moment now. Apologies. And so, or in the opening chapter, like "Ladies and Gentlemen," Lenny Bruce by Albert Goldman and Lawrence Schiller. It's a great book. And that opening chapter, I think it's like a very 24-hour period of life for Lenny Bruce at that time, which is all about drug procurements. For those who are watching the video stream, there you go. Lenny Bruce. Got two Lenny Bruce things there. Lenny Bruce, a lot of the references go over my head. He's not funny. I just like what he represents. A man of his time, probably would have loved him in that era. But it's what he ran represents, and kind of the you know, ground zero of the robust confessional within stand-up comedy, within that medium. Mort Sahl as well, but that was more of a political slant. I mean, look, you look at some of the stuff that Lenny Bruce was getting away with in the 50s and 60s. And even by today's standard, it's like, I mean, actually, I was going to say even by today's standard, but today we've become modern day a lot more puritanical, and we're policing stuff a lot more. We're worried about the knock-on effects of working through stuff and saying stuff on stage that might just be a direct transmission of the id, and that can be ugly. That can be ugly if it's unfettered, if there's no mitigating agent or intermediary, also known as the sensible part of your brain that goes no, don't, not especially that word, do not use that. No, and that can dismantle an entire career. It can fucking firebomb it in one full swoop. Napalm, you know, napalm the villagers. That's what that can do to your life. It's self-detonatory instinct, which I have. I'm worried sometimes on these podcasts. I don't think I've said anything that particularly bad. I think as well, it's where it's coming from. Good thing about a podcast is people get to know you. You've got plenty of time to get to know you, so they know it doesn't come from a bad place. Fundamentally, I'm an all right person. Well, I'm fine. So and any darkness that resides in me, I'm happy to get it out, mate. I'm happy to be transparent, full disclosure. It's the people who try to establish themselves as pillars of virtue. They're the fuckers you need to keep an eye on. They're the fuck. Honestly, a lot of the, especially sort of the low, very low profile, people who are outed on the comedy circuit, but really more like, you know, the open mic circuit. Some a little bit beyond that point. The ones who were outed as being, you know, pests or predatory or out and out rapists would designate themselves as, you know, a male feminist and that kind of shit. You can have respect and understanding about the problems that women face and be an ally, do what you can to support and not be part of the problem. But know that by your very nature as a man, you might inadvertently pose a problem, and also not to just automatically assume you'll be seen as a benign, approachable presence, which is a thing I've had to learn. Like, I mean, women are rightfully conditioned to see you as a threat until they don't. So you have to earn that. You have to earn that trust. And that's the way it should be. You should have to earn that trust by your actions, not by your words. Words are cheap. By your actions show that you're not gonna cause any problems. And that you'll actually go out of your way, go above and beyond to try and prevent other men from causing problems, which, you know, I'm hard to assess yourself. I'm not going to assess myself in that. Other people, other women will be able to say whether I've failed or succeeded in that regards. So I was acquainted with the repetition and once again-ness of procuring drugs to achieve an ever-decreasing period of giddiness, procuring drugs to achieve an ever-decreasing period of giddiness, followed by emptiness and existential reflection. So an example, 22nd of March 2015, I remember I'd run out of hydrocodone tablets. Withdrawal was already kicking in. But 600 were being delivered to the flat. So I sat waiting, immobile, no television on, nothing, for hours and hours in anticipation of their arrival. As the limit was 200 tablets per purchase, and within a 30-day time frame, I'd ordered from three different online pharmacies when they were still selling dihydrocodone. They don't anymore. And lying through my teeth on the online questionnaires. And if you want a sort of more controlled stuff like oxy and dimorphine and that shit, you have to go elsewhere. There's ways, but I'm not going to advertise those ways to you. I'll advertise getting help. You feel a sense of severance in your connection with other people, if you're out of step with other people. And this is where, like, people overcomplicate recovery, and you get this talk about the higher power and stuff, which I'm a spiritual person. I consider myself an etherealist and a religious person. But a lot of people are alienated by that because they hear religion, they think edicts, doctrine, catechisms. And they don't want that. And when you sometimes go into AA or NA meetings, you get people who will be very strict and dogmatic in their approach. They assume that works for everyone. They'll be like, this is how you've got to do it. This is how things are done. You can't do that. You've got to, it's not, this is what recovery is about. It is literally going into a room, sharing a space with like-minded people, actually people who are probably very different, but like-minded in one aspect, in one vital aspect, which is that they are addicts, and listening to people speak and speaking yourself and offloading some of that burden onto a group who will all shoulder it for each other. Being in a place with some people who narf love banging on sometimes too much, really. There's ones who hog the room, I'll be honest. There's ones who hog the floor. There's ones who hog the floor. And they start getting into... One woman brought out fucking receipts because she felt she got mugged off from the co-op. And she got out receipts as evidence that she was getting mugged off for £2.36. And, yeah. And then afterwards, she went to her car and got the item where she thought she'd been overcharged. Complain and share, and you know, to talk about what's going on in your life and the triggers for what your particular triggers are. But no, there is a limit. Have some social awareness, but there's really not a limit, and there shouldn't be. And she's if that's what was helping her to not pick up that day, then she's totally in her right to do that. But that is all it is: sitting in a room with people chatting or listening, big part of it, and then saying your own shit in your car. Higher power could be like one bloke. Someone told me that they would pick the bus that got them to the meeting. I always thought that was a really nice touch. It's quite quaint, quite pedestrian, parochial, quotidian, if that's the right word for it. So just a bus, isn't it? My higher power is a fucking bus. Why'd you pick the bus? Because the bus transports me to the place that I get well. This is nice. Mine's a bit of sweet corn, so I couldn't think of anything else. The therapist said, you might want to change that one. I said, no, because I've imbued, just through repetition, I've imbued it with so much now that to me, that bit of sweet corn represents something. It's imbued with too much. What started off as a joke and a novelty has become something. It gives me something thinking of that horrible little bit of sweet corn under a hoarder sofa. It made me sick. And I first saw it, but then I remember at the time, I think my granddad was dying of cancer. I thought that could be something. That could be anything. Go on and prosper, my little corn. You can be whatever you want. You can be a whole fucking wheat field. Is that where sweet corn comes from? Yeah, corn. You can be a small corn field. From a tiny corn to a massive corn field. That then gets completely eradicated by forest fires because of global warming, and we're all going to die. It's not looking good for any of us. Why should I prioritize you? You're fucking corn. I'll eat you. That's how insignificant you are. I'll fucking eat you. I used to say that in fights. I didn't initiate fights. If I got into them, it was always it's a righteous indignation, like sticking up for the little man, not knowing that I too was the little man. These guys were UFC fighters or naval officers. So I could endure a lot of punishment. I couldn't necessarily dole it out. A few bloody noses, a few things like that. And one was a guy who I said, big fucking hefty guy, tribal tattoos. I said I was going to eat him. I mean, at the time, I was quite malnourished. Drug addict. What was I fucking thinking? So the 22nd of March 2015, I remembered I'd run out of the hydrocodone tablets, withdrawal was already kicking in, blah, 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 blah. So I lived with my ex at the time, but she was at work. I had the freedom to sit without interruptions. An almost pathological myopia, which is like tunnel vision, single-mindedness, and an actual ocular ocular degeneration. But when a delivery notification came through on my phone, it turned out I'd accidentally ordered them to my old university address in Portsmouth. So I was utterly frantic and ignoring all other responsibilities like meeting my girlfriend at the hospital where she worked or buying our weekly shopping or paying our utility bills. I was like, yeah, no wonder she used to fucking beat me. I hopped on a train and did a round trip from Essex to Portsmouth and back again just to get my fix. And that's drug addiction. And mentally replaying that journey to nowhere as if it's still happening, that's dementia. Tom McCarthy, who's a brilliant writer, I love Tom McCarthy, in an essay about Belgian writer Jean-Philippe Toussaint, who I also fucking love, writes about Toussaint's penchant for quasi-repeating narrative loops that see an eminently unreliable narrator, someone with dementia, someone with drugs in the system, or going through withdrawal, sees this unreliable narrator trace and retrace circuits through corridors of a hotel and the obsessive attention to surfaces and objects. Like my Nanny June's little totems that she used to make when she was off of, which is a nutbag, or Lomping Rose's trophies. This woman who used to hoard trophies. We distributed trophies for the participants of a care home tour show. And Rose and Shirley were these two women. Rose was really feisty, sort of a little goblin. God rest her soul. Shirley reminded me of remembering Rex the Run, like Tuesday, Vince. That Shirley was like that. And she always used to just say, I like you. You're my friend. That's what she used to say. And they were sitting there with the trophies, and Rose was like, is this it? And then she turned to Shirley, who went to her, I like you. And she went, and you know, Shirley, like she was attached to Shirley. She couldn't bear to let go of Shirley. Even though, like, I mean, the shallowness of their relationship, like they had nothing but their the whatever comfort Rose got from Shirley, because Shirley couldn't have a conversation, and Rose snatched Shirley's trophy and went, "You did nothing for yours, so I'm having that," and then blew a raspberry in her face, so spittle landed on Shirley's face, but. On her oblivious face, Shirley just sat there totally oblivious. And from then on, every trophy that was the amount of trophies in Rose's room would multiply throughout the week, where she was obviously going around and just stealing everyone's trophies. The effect here, he continues, stems from the naive individual's skewed encounter with systems larger than himself, an encounter which, reprised again and again, plagues out for Henri Bergson's first rule of comedy, that life should be reshaped into a self-repeating mechanism. So you can see how that pertains to drug abuse and being in care homes, addiction. I realised during my rehab induction with Adolf the Albino, total respect for him, but and Dad giving me suicide tips, and the other assistants unscrewing the lids of shampoo bottles and poking in a thin lolly stick, I realised how residents must feel on their first day in the care home. I'm here itemising their meagre possessions. Strangers are bombarding them with false niceties. Family members, if they're lucky enough to have them, nervously wring their hands, and a bloated black cloud hangs over the occasion. You can't quite pinpoint the source of this impending doom, this portentousness. Portentousness is what I mean. Portent, yeah, it's like doom in it. But it's there. And from then on, you're navigating your way through a bureaucratic and medical tesseract. Without a map or a fully functioning mind, and you're forever bumping your head on an impenetrable glass partition. At least I could eventually leave. Hello. So, yeah. So that's, maybe I could read a bit more. So one delusion I did allow myself is in rehab is the false justification that opiates improved my writing and performing. My therapists helpfully pointed out during our daily group sessions that I hadn't written anything for a year, hadn't gigged in 5 months. And newly clean and in rehab, I was producing extensive daily diaries. And I always look forward to reading them. And one of my earliest cogs, which is change of goals, was don't over-intellectualize everything or use humor as a diversionary tactic. These tics could obstruct my ability to drill into my emotional core. Or, I mean, with humor, it can, I think it can play a vital role. I think it can actually, no, they're right. I do that. I undermine seriousness. I like to prick solemnity like a prick. So yeah, we'll do a little bit of that. I mean, that was kind of me, that was a recitation. So we'll, as the show usually goes, I'll pick up a book and kind of we'll read some of the stuff on that and get into some shit. All right, let me see if I what books I could do it with. The book of the occult. We've talked about cultism quite a lot, haven't we, though? Haven't we? Actually, yeah, I think I will do that. The Book of the Occult. Okay. I mean, isn't there still, like, if we talk about albinism, is that the correct way of saying it as well? Albinism. Let me double check. Albinism.
Albinism.
Yes. And isn't there in some countries where the albinos are still like fucking, I was going to say harvested, I mean, killed, like albino genocide, because they believe that the persecution of albinism, blood libel in Africa, in Tanzania, in Burundi, hunted for their body parts. Yeah, because don't they feel like they can use their body parts? So in reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa, on a Thursday night in early March, a Malawian man named Gilbert Dare was woken up by the sound of people trying to drill through his wall. He was convinced that hunters had come to kill him for his body parts. When his wife screamed, neighbours came to help and fended off the attackers. But Dare no longer feels safe in the streets or at home. He worries that the hunters will return. This is horrible. Dare has albinism, a condition that makes him a valuable commodity in parts of eastern and southern Africa. Like elephants and rhino, they are hunted and killed for their body parts, which can fetch thousands of dollars and often trafficked across borders. Slayings of people with albinism where body parts are used in witchcraft rituals because of superstitions that they can bring riches, success, power, sexual conquest. Children are especially vulnerable. Jesus. Oh no, too dark. Feel a bit bad. Feel a bit bad on Adolf. Yeah, I mean, this is where, like I said, I call myself an etherealist and stuff, but archaic belief systems like that. I mean, I'm wary of talking about stuff that comes from a veritable news source, or not veritable, trusted news source, just Los Angeles Times. But it, I don't want to play into the really damaging perception of parts of Africa as being full of savagery. For those who are only listening and not seeing me on the video, I say that in quotation marks, because that's such a that's such a damaging and detrimental view of an entire continent and people, Western people, have a very closed-minded view on this stuff. Even look, you can see the way I'm kind of dancing around it. I'm tiptoeing around this particular topic because I'm wary of making a faux pas or straying into, you know, culturally, politically combustible territory. Which I did recently. I mean, I did it with, so I've been organizing this talk with David Baddiel to promote his new book. I'll tell you the details about that soon on my Twitter. And it's with David Baddiel, my brilliant Jewish friend Davina is taking over hosting duties. And then there'll be a panel of UK Jewish comedians. And they'll be discussing the specific contours of anti-Semitism, how their Jewishness informs their comedy and outlook, and whether they've faced any obstacles and hurdles within the UK comedy industry as a result of their Jewish identity, and what those type of obstacles look like, what they think about their prevalence, if they indeed think they're prevalent. And so, yeah, I'm arranging it. So I think it's a really important conversation to have at the moment. And I know a lot of Jewish comedians from my... I've got Jewish matrilineage, but it goes back a couple of generations. So it hasn't informed my identity in any way other than just, you know, I read a lot about Judaism and Jewishness, and they are two different things. So I have a vested interest in it, but I don't know if it's personal or if it pertains to my identity. My mum said, like, my nan would talk about it a lot, and they've identified some parts of the upbringing that might be like residual Jewishness. But I thought, I was going to initially be part of it. So I thought, well, you know, a Quaker on the panel would be quite funny, but I think it'd be more of a distraction than anything else. And I don't want to be seen to be, what's the word I was using? I'm just trying to find the chat I had with my friend. What's it? Yeah, I don't want to be seen to be capitalizing on the current discourse around Judaism, but I just wanted to provide a platform for Jewish comedians to be able to discuss it. And even though it's not their job to do so, to inform the wider public and especially their peers within comedy or the kind of people who are comedy aficionados come to see a lot of UK comedy. Anyway, because there was a lot of moving pieces I was trying to bring in to alignment, it's a bit of a logistical nightmare. Someone suggested a date for us to put on this show, this stream. Happened to fall on the Shabbat. Again, is that pronounced right? Which is, you know, the Friday and Saturday. It's Friday after sundown.
Shabbat.
That's it. The Sabbath. It happened to be, yeah, it was Friday evening. And a brilliant, brilliant Orthodox Jewish comedian who I love her very much. She raised her concerns about this. It being quite exclusionary to the Orthodox Jewish community, and it's you know, this is, it speaks to a wider issue for Orthodox Jewish creatives, where their opportunities are limited because of their observance, their religious observance. And the irony of making this, the irony of putting together this show when a huge swathe of the Jewish population are then excluded, even though we was going to put on a buy or rent option to watch it at their own convenience afterwards. It's still exactly like these were totally valid concerns she raised. I'm really glad she raised them, and we spoke it through. And then I've managed to reschedule it. But it was I was prioritizing things I shouldn't have been prioritizing. I should have been prioritizing the inclusivity of the whole Jewish community, and so that was a massive fucking balls up on my part, for which I can only apologize. But that will be coming out soon in March. So keep an eye out for that. Now, this is also another sore point, because I've gone on to talk about Judaism and Jewishness, and now I'm about to segue into the occult. And that's a recurring trope that's leveled against the Jewish people, like stuff to do with like blood libel and occultism and that kind of shit. So let's create a crowbar separation. Fucking hell, I'm tiptoeing around political and cultural landmines today. I'm basically saying, no one gives a shit, really. No one fucking cares what I have to say, but I'm creating a crowbar separation between those two topics and occultism. So we'll do a quick one from the introduction. So Tariq Goddard, rereading Squire Toby's will after a 15-year gap, reveals a far longer, nastier, and more discursive tale than the experiment in heart-stopping brevity I falsely committed to memory. The economy with which I remember the story being told is a masterly illusion created by Fanu's frilling technique and his disregard for the rules and conventions of writing in general, and horror writing in particular. I really want to write a good horror. I really want to write a really good horror. I've recounted some horrific visions and dreams I've had in the past. I used to really disturb my best friend Louis's mum, Tracy, who is like my mum, my second mum. And I think I want to write a horror at some point. Fanu spares the reader nothing, ignoring the old saw of creative writing classes that one should always show and never tell. Instead, he dwells a great and painfully entertaining length on telling everything as colourfully as he can. It's not the filling in the gaps that our interiority and psychology will always be more horrific than what's presented to us. It's an old adage when it comes to horror writing. Never show the monster. But this fella does it differently. What he chooses to show, he shows only sparingly. Oh, no, he doesn't. The occasional sight eclipsed by his gory love of spelling everything out, elevating overwriting to the level of technique. Overwriting, overwrought. I used to do writing as very florid and overwrought. And as I got older, really scaled it back and whittled it down. And it's all the better for it. But a lot more economical. And being a stand-up comedian in conjunction with a writer, that has helped me to achieve that, because as a stand-up comedian, brevity is key. Being economical with your language is key, unless you make a artistic choice, like Stuart Lee, who he's a masterful at reiterating stuff and repeating it ad nauseum, so it creates different waves of laughter, and doing that taking that to extreme lengths. So it goes through funny to awkward, back to funny, back to painfully unfunny now. Way too far. But through pure hubris, he's pushing it even further, and now it becomes funny again. And the bit Rod Liddell chewing on a poppadom is a bit he did. I think I saw him do it at the Royal Albert Hall, which he dragged it out. He really dragged it out. This was like minutes long of just him making the sound of Rod Liddell chewing a poppadom. It was fucking hilarious. In the end, it created almost giddy, ecstatic, herniating laughter. But he said when he did it and when he recorded it for the show, Stuart Lee's Comedy Vehicle, didn't work, bombed. But his idea of bombing, I think, is probably very, very different to mine. But maybe not, because I know he said when he was younger, maybe wasn't as mindful of causing the audience. He wasn't as worried as about the theatre of cruelty aspect. Because now, he realizes people are sacrificing a night together to go and watch him live, getting babysitters and all that kind of stuff. So he doesn't want to make it uncomfortable for them. He wants to give them a good show. But maybe when he was younger and more experimental, we'll worry about that as much. He got some pleasure from the complete eradication of good cheer and goodwill within the room. Okay. And I'm at that level now of like, I would quite like to do that. I'd quite like to play with that idea. But I think actually we've gone on too long, if anything. See, this is like the thing of like, you wait for a bus and then five come along at once. And you wait a couple more days for a podcast and then it's too, I overburden you with podcasts. Fucking overwhelm you with podcasts. Gavage feed you podcast. Gavage, I am really the Gavage feeding of the podcast world. The Gavage feeder, the Gavage feeding podcaster. And funny bloke. Funny little bloke. Funny little bloke, but sometimes serious. Talking about albinos getting disemboweled and slaughtered and dismembered and cut up so that they can be sold for fucking horny drugs. Sold as horny drugs. You chomp, I'm gonna bloody suckle on Adolf. Gonna pop Adolf in my mouth. Gonna lick his head and then get horny. So it works. Yeah. So thank you for listening, as always, and massive love to you all. Goodbye.